You're listening to a UC San Diego podcast.
Okay. How's the microphone? Is that all right? Is that audible? Not so much. You hear me okay? Let's try another battery then. Okay. Let's try that. You hear me okay? Yeah? All right. Let's get going. Hello? Hello? All right, welcome back. Hope the midterm wasn't too horrible. Everyone found it easy? Yeah? Not so much. So I know in my undergraduate class, everyone's complaining on Piazza about the midterm. Everyone here has learned not to complain, but maybe you had some of the same feelings. So I think things weren't quite as bad as people thought they might have been. Here is the grade distribution. I'm not sure if absolutely everyone's up there. There are only 77 marked so far, so a few of you are probably still missing. Things look roughly like this. So this, to me, looks like a pretty canonical Gaussian distribution. Yeah, I think that's how midterm grades should look. The top-ranked people almost aced it, not quite. So apparently there were a few really, really tough questions in there. The highest mark was only 90. Hardly anyone failed it, and the people who did fail it, they really only failed it by 2 or 3 marks. There's still room to get 2 or 3 marks back in the next 4 weeks. It'll be okay. So I don't think there's anything too wrong with this picture. That's my opinion. Of course, last year there was no midterm, so I think last year it was possible to just ace every aspect of the class. I mean, the assignments can be aced. The homework can definitely be aced. The midterm is impossible to ace. So I appreciate that, on average, everyone maybe lost 6 or 7 marks that they wouldn't have lost had there been no midterm. I'll make sure those are made up for somehow and that the average grade remains basically the same as it was last year. I think last year, nearly everyone who did all 4 assessments or all 3 assessments last year got something between a B minus and an A plus. It shouldn't be so bad. It'll be okay. Maybe all these people are taking the class pass-fail anyway. I don't know. If you feel your grade is much worse than you thought it should be, talk to me. We can figure out ways to make up the difference that you need. Okay, so that's the midterm. We'll give it back soon. I've decided not to give out things on the desk at the front of the class anymore. It was too much of a horror show. So I'll just leave graded assessments outside my office. The TA should give me back homework too tomorrow, hopefully the midterm as well, if they finish marking it. And I'll announce on Piazza that things are available outside and you can come and collect them in your own time without having to fight for them. So I'd give a few tips, hints and tips about the assignment after the lecture if I have time. Still a week and a day before it's due. So this is the undergrad class still. Ignore that slide. So there'll be extra office hours to discuss the assignment on Thursday and Friday. There's no class Wednesday because it's Veterans Day. Remember that the Kaggle times are in UTC, all right? So I can't change that. It's not my website. I think Kaggle says something like 8 a.m. Wednesday morning. I don't know what. It's due midnight Tuesday night. So just remember that discrepancy. If you look at the time remaining field on Kaggle, that's accurate, even if the closing date is not. Anything else administrative I wanted to mention? I don't think so. Everything else is okay administratively? We're happy? Okay, so let's get back to the main topic that we started Wednesday 2 weeks ago. We'll finish today, which is how can we solve these kind of predictive tasks that we care about using text? So 2 weeks ago on Wednesday, we were looking at things like can we determine whether some article has a positive or negative sentiment about the topics it's discussing based on the kind of words it uses. So does this article have positive or negative assessment about the USPS based on the words like flatulent and buzz and so forth? Can you do the same thing with categorization? Can you figure out what topics or what categories or genres is this article about based on words like Apple and computers and wearable and automobile and so forth? So kind of the same task we've been looking at way back since week one, regression, classification, but trying to use text as features, which somehow would change how we could come up with a good model. And of course, things like helpfulness votes, which all of you should be intimately familiar with by now, since we've been looking at the assignment in the homework. And actually, quickly, while I mention that, how is that assignment going? Where's our leaderboard? Goodness me. So this is helpfulness prediction. I see people have gotten pretty serious about that. Data Musketeer, are you here? Or are you staying anonymous? What's that? Okay, well, you can reveal yourself next week if you wish to claim your prize and you're still winning, and you're winning on the private leaderboard too. But congratulations. There's a pretty big range of answer qualities. I upped the submission limit earlier today to 20 per day. I know I decided I didn't want to, but I always end up folding. I'm happy to see, as usual, there's a pretty high correlation between number of submissions you've made and your position on the leaderboard. Nobody down the bottom has made more than two or three attempts. The people up the top have made on the order of like 15 to 20 attempts. So somehow, and as you'd kind of hope, effort seems to be correlated with results. How about for the other task, rating prediction? I think it's a similar story. Everyone submitted just about something. I mean, you can really see for this task that it's you're really fighting in the margin to get a good result. The sort of dumbest possible baseline is not that much worse than the smartest possible model that I've described in class. Of course, I mean, really, it could be a lot better, even though the MSE is not much lower, because it could totally change the way products are ranked and so on and so forth. But in terms of the absolute value of the score, it's only a tiny amount differentiating people. Okay, so we can see the final update on next Monday's class before the winners are revealed on Wednesday. But yeah, like we saw 2 weeks ago, we can use these sort of text features to solve the kind of tasks we care about, like helpfulness prediction for the assignment. What we're going to look at more this week is these sort of user personalization, recommender systems type tasks, again, but using text. So can you imagine, given whatever your ideas about my interests are, could you figure out that these articles might be good recommendations for me based on the words in those articles? Or even more broadly, or maybe more simply, could you come up with a good similarity measure between documents? So given that I'm reading this document, could you come up with recommendations of related or similar documents? So what is it that makes this document about meatloaf similar to this document about polpetone? Who knows what polpetone is? I saw someone nodding. I don't want to admit it, but what are the words in these articles that make these two things similar, for instance? And that sort of will allow us to build things like recommender systems based on text. What we did last week was look at these things like bag of words models. So we say we have some document. We're just going to throw away syntax altogether and do kind of the simplest possible thing by counting how many times does each word from our very, very, very large dictionary appear in each document. So this document can be described by the fact that it uses the word "a" 150 times, uses the word "Bjork" some number of times, so on and so forth. We saw various improvements of this kind of thing. The basic bag of words model is just throwing away syntax altogether and saying these two documents are somehow equivalent, where one of them is just a reordered version of the other one, because all we're doing is counting word frequencies. We saw a bunch of extensions like n-gram-based models, so we count appearances of adjacent pairs of words. We saw things like stop words and stemming, so we can get rid of very, very frequently occurring or words, or we can find two words that correspond to the same concept. We saw we can get rid of punctuation and capitalization, so on and so forth. And I guess at the end of the day, we ended up with some very simple model where we just say, take some fixed length dictionary of maybe 5,000 words, and we'll just count the 5,000 most frequently occurring n-grams with punctuation removed and the words are stemmed or whatever we like. So we developed bag of words models, which are a very naive way of representing documents, but we added some sophistication on top of them to make them kind of effective by using n-grams and by doing a bunch of filtering steps, essentially. And what do we end up with at the end of the day? We ended up with this basic sort of regression-type framework where we're associating weights with words or with n-grams that say, are those associated with a positive or a negative sentiment? Or are they associated with a document being about a particular category or genre? So, you know, any of these sort of linear regression or classification-type models we've seen so far, we just saw how we can apply them when we have features that are based on word counts. Okay, so that's as far as we got. Today we'd like to look at these kind of dimensionality reduction, recommender systems type approaches to text documents. So everything so far is the regression classification approaches. What about dimensionality reduction and recommendation? How can we apply those same ideas when we're using text? So when we did recommender systems, we essentially saw two ways you could do recommendation. We said you could do recommendation by coming up with good similarity functions. So can you identify that two products are similar in terms of the sets of users who bought them? That's things like the Descartes similarity, which looks at set intersections, the cosine similarity, which would look at the difference between angles of these binary purchase vectors, and we looked at things like the Pearson correlation, which would use some normalized similarity between ratings. Whatever, we were finding similarities between items based on users. And then we saw dimensionality reduction approaches to recommender systems, which would say, okay, can we come up with a low-dimensional representation of a user, which might say what does the user like, and a low-dimensional representation of an item, which might say to what extent does the item exhibit those properties that the user likes. So that's similarity functions and dimensionality reductions for product recommendation. Today we'll look at the same sorts of things, but for text. So how can we come up with a good notion of whether two documents are similar based on the words they use? And as we'll see, sort of naive similarity functions on things like bags of words just don't work well. So we've got to be a bit smarter. And how can we come up with dimensionality reduction approaches to compress or to represent words and documents to discover things like topics? So what have we dealt with so far? We've come up with these huge vocabularies of frequently occurring words to build our 5,000-dimensional bag of words representation or whatever you like. But one issue we kind of saw, or at least we peeked at a little bit, is that the most informative words may be very, very rare ones. Like proper nouns may be very predictive of the category of an article, or sort of extremely superlative or negative language may be rare but highly predictive. So I guess the example we looked at was a word like exceptional in a beer review. Very highly correlated with a positive rating, but it's a very rare word by definition. It's very rare for something to be exceptional. So this kind of very naive sort of just counting the frequency of a word and throwing away things that are too infrequent may be bad if these rare words happen to be the most informative. So we'd like to come up with some smarter way of measuring the informativeness of a word, which isn't just tied to how many times that word appeared. So to see why this is an issue and why you need to do something better, you can imagine taking the kind of similarity measures like the cosine similarity, whatever you like, and applying them to the kind of representations we've seen so far. So far, what do we have? We have a bag of words. Just counts the number of times every single word appears. What would happen if we tried to use a bag of words to measure the similarity between two, it could be reviews of movies. Could we say if Harry Potter is a similar movie to Pitch Black based on the reviews of both, and based on the words that are used in the reviews of both? So, you know, you kind of remember from the recommender systems lecture, what we're doing is we're taking some representation of these things. Here's your representation of Harry Potter. Here's your representation of Pitch Black. And you're embedding them into this, in this case, it's a very high-dimensional space, saying what are the bag of words representations of these two items, and you're going to say they're similar if the angle between these is low. So how does a bag of words representation look? Well, we have our words sorted by frequency, R of the and et cetera, and maybe the word wizard and the word space, they come much later on, so on and so forth. This is our dictionary. Then the Harry Potter representation is going to look like, I don't know, 480 and, you know, 500 and 312 and whatever. Wizard probably appears a dozen times or so. Space probably appears zero. I don't think any of those movies were set in space. This is your bag of words representation of Harry Potter. You do the same thing for Pitch Black. Again, it's going to have a huge number of appearances of the word of the... I'm just making up numbers using the best random number generator I have in my head. Wizards don't appear. Space maybe appears a few times.
Okay, so you can imagine now using these representations, computing the cosine similarity, everything's going to be pretty similar to each other because everything uses these very common words very, very frequently. But the point is, and the issue is, that these very common words are going to dominate your similarity computation. These ones with very, very small values don't really matter a great deal. Okay. So is this an issue? Well, maybe, maybe not. Is the difference in frequency of these very common words going to be good at determining whether these documents are similar or not? I suppose it kind of depends what your task is, right? So this could be useful for something, like if I wanted to figure out which of Shakespeare's plays were actually written by Christopher Marlowe or something like that. Or I want to figure out, are two documents plagiarized? Are they actually written by the same person? Or are they written by different people? Representations like this could be useful. Like this could give us a very high-level notion of whether the writing styles of two documents are similar, even if they're about totally different topics. So different people would use the word "are of" and "the" perhaps with different frequency. On the other hand, if we want to do something like categorization, "are of" and "the" are not going to be representative at all of the category of a product. So if we want to find out whether a document about recipes is more similar to another document about recipes versus a document about space travel, then these words are going to be useless. These words are going to be the ones that ought to carry all the weight. So we need to come up with some kind of document representation that's going to allow those words to be more effective. So here's an article. Can you look at it for 5 seconds and tell me what the topic of this article is? Is it to or that or and? It's not a hard question. Katy Perry. That's a pretty good guess.
I guess it's about, I mean, you could say it's about Katy Perry and it's about Taylor Swift and it's about friendships and feuds and so on and so forth. I guess really it's an article about pop music, to be even more broad. The question is, what makes it an article about Katy Perry rather than Taylor Swift, or Taylor Swift rather than an article about the word that? I mean, the, for instance, appears 12 times. Taylor Swift appears 3 times. I guess Katy Perry appears about the same number. So given that the appears 4 times as often, why is it about Taylor Swift and not the? Yeah, I mean, proper nouns seem to be important things, but if this were a language you'd never seen before, and I didn't tell you which words were proper nouns, how would you determine its topic? Yeah, so that's the basic thing we're hearing. I mean, the is common, but it's always common. So the is no more common in this document than it is in all documents, whereas Taylor Swift is rare usually, but very common here. So to come up with a measure of relevance of a word in a document, we don't just need to look at the document, we need to look at our entire corpus of documents to say, how much does the word appear in this document and how little does it appear across other documents? So we'll need these kind of two concepts, one of which is the tone frequency, which says how many times does the word appear in the document, and the other of which is the inverse document frequency, which says how rare is this across all documents. I can sort of write those out. So TF of a term T in a document D, it's a term, that's a doc, is equal to the number of appearances number of times the term appears in the document. And the document frequency is going to of the term across all documents, so that's all docs, is the number of times T appears everywhere. So what we'd like is to find words that appear a lot in this document but are very rare across all documents. So that would mean they have a high term frequency but a low document frequency. So we want something like high TF, low DF. This is going to be our sort of intuitive notion of what makes a word relevant. Okay, so we get those two things. We get our tone frequency. Taylor Swift has a tone frequency of 3 in that document because it appears 3 times, simple as that. Inverse document frequency, well, I'd need to build a corpus and see how often the word Taylor Swift appears in it. I didn't do that, but we're just going to take the number of all documents and say what fraction of those contain, well, this is really the inverse document frequency, so we're going to take the number of documents that mention Taylor Swift divided by the number of documents. We want that to be low, so we take the inverse of that, which we want to be high. So we'd like a large fraction of all documents. So the IDF will be high if not many documents discuss Taylor Swift. Did I say everything wrong just then, or is... I think that's right. Okay. So then our TF-IDF score is just the product of these two things. So TF-IDF equals TF times IDF. So high tone frequency, low document frequency, or high inverse document frequency. This sort of log seems like it's a bit of a made-up term, but really if you want to get mathematical about it, you can think of the probability that a term is discussed in a document is just the fraction of documents that mention that term, so the IDF can be thought of as a log probability or something like that. I don't know if that helps with the intuition, but there's a log in front of it. Okay? So, basic output of this model is that the TF-IDF is high only if the word is more frequent in this document than it is in other documents. TF-IDF is low either if it's the word is rare in this document, or if the word is common, but it's common everywhere. So, TF-IDF is then a reasonable measure of whether a particular word is relevant to a particular document given a corpus of documents. Sometimes these terms are defined a little bit differently than what I gave here. So I said the TF, the tone frequency, is just the count, how many times does the word appear in a document. This has sort of one basic issue with it, which is that for longer documents, the counts are always going to be higher, but the inverse document frequency is going to be the same. So for longer documents, TF goes up, IDF stays the same, so longer documents just get higher relevance scores for every word, which maybe doesn't make sense, right? You don't necessarily want the TF-IDF scores to grow with the document length. So two things people do to fix this. One, they just use a delta function, which says, does the word appear in the document? Yes or no. This fixes the invariance to length issue. It has another kind of issue, which is that for very, very long documents, every word's kind of going to appear eventually. So it's maybe too coarse a notion. The other way is to take the frequency of the word, which is what we had before, and divide this by the frequency of the most common word. So the tone frequency is then a value between 0 and 1, saying to what extent is this word the most rare or the most common in the document. This gives you a pretty elegant and smooth way of normalizing for length. Okay. So how do you use this? Well, we use it in exactly the same way. We're still going to measure things like cosine similarity. But instead of doing that on the bag of words representation, we'll do it on these TF-IDF weighted representations where every word in the bag of words is replaced by its TF-IDF score for that document. Okay, so now intuitively, hopefully, if you agree with this principle behind TF-IDF, you're going to be measuring similarity by measuring the words that are most characteristic. Okay, so... And then, like we usually are, this gives us just a feature vector, which represents a document, now in terms of its TF-IDF rather than its bag of words representation. So an obvious question is whether any of this really matters if we're going to be learning a parameter vector anyway. Like, all the time, we're taking our feature vector and we're saying which of the features are relevant. In other words, they have a high or a large or a small parameter. So you might think, well, all I'm doing here is increasing or decreasing the weight of each feature in a bag of words model. So if I decrease the weight of a feature, if I increase or decrease the weight of a feature, couldn't I decrease or increase the weight of the corresponding parameter and get exactly the same model? So, you know, does any of this make a difference if I'm going to be learning which words are relevant anyway through my parameter vector? The answer is yes. So there's two reasons. One of which is that TF-IDF is applying a different weighting to every single document. So it's not just that you're rescaling every word in your feature vector, you're applying a different rescaling per document of every word in your feature vector. So there isn't a nice equivalence between these two models. This is really, it's not just rescaling the features, it's doing a different scaling for every single row of your feature vector, so these two expressions cannot be made equivalent just by changing the values of theta. The second is actually maybe a more subtle issue, which is about regularization. So all the time we've been regularizing our parameter vectors, we've said we want theta w to be like small or, you know, nearly uniform or something like that. But the actual way the parameters are scaled can change what it means for a feature vector to be regular or irregular. And you can kind of think about it this way. All the time, we're multiplying our features by our parameters, and we want our parameters to be small. But you think, well, I have my bag of words representation, which is going to have very big weights for these very common words and smaller weights for everything else. I have my parameter vector. Maybe here's wizard over here, which is very predictive. Maybe I'll get a parameter vector like this for my bag of words representation. And I could think, well, yes, if I ran a TF-IDF, then all these very common words are going to have low weights. Wizard's going to have a very sort of high scale. And hopefully that's going to mean, well, these still have no weight. This has a relatively smaller weight than it did before. Yeah, because here I had a very small scale feature for wizard, and I had to have a very large parameter to account for it. And here I have a very large scale for the feature, and I can get an equivalently good model with a much smaller parameter. Maybe that's a bit subtle, but the point is, when I use a regularizer, it matters what scale the different features are. It's very cheap to use a big feature, and it's very expensive to use a very small scale feature. So if your good features are the ones that have very low scale, then it's going to be very expensive from the perspective of the regularizer to select a good model. But if you have a good feature vector, in the sense that the useful features are the ones that have high weight anyway, then it will be much easier to regularize your model. Okay? It's, in essence, the having a good feature representation is doing a lot of the work for you. If you've weighted your features the correct way, it's more likely that the parameter vectors are close to uniform, right? Because you've already learned good weights for your features. Okay. That, I think, is about all I wanted to say about TF-IDF. And really, that's all I wanted to say about sort of similarity-based approaches to dealing with text. The next thing I wanted to talk about is dimensionality reduction. So are we all happy with TF-IDF, measuring similarities, coming up with this sort of relevance measures for words in documents? It's okay? Yes. Excellent. How am I going for time? Okay, I'll maybe speed up a little bit. All right, so the next thing we want to do is look at dimensionality reduction. So we've done this for things like recommender systems, where we want to come up with a good representation of a user and an item in terms of the properties of the item and how much the user likes each of those properties. Now we'd like to do the same thing for text, in the sense that we would say, well, how can I find the low dimensional structure in this document? And low dimensional structure here would mean essentially some corpus of movie reviews would decompose into some small number of topics, where topics are essentially sets of words that are used in similar contexts. So if I want to solve my predictive tasks like classification or whatever you like, maybe I don't need to count how many times has the word used this document used the word action and space and loud and explosion. I can just say how often does it use words from the action topic versus words from the sci-fi topic. So we've seen this little bit in the dimensionality reduction lectures and also week 4, actually, rather than 5, the recommender systems lectures. We've seen how we can use dimensionality reduction techniques to compress things like a matrix of people's ratings, or even more simply with PCA, how we can use dimensionality reduction techniques to compress things like feature vectors. So this is what we saw using PCA. We're given some big matrix where each row is maybe a user and each column is an item. We can just take the eigenvectors of R, R transpose, the eigenvectors of R transpose R, and the eigenvalues, which we kind of proved when we looked at the proof of PCA. We proved that these are going to be the best things to take in terms of trying to compress this rating matrix or to compress this feature matrix, such that you would replace this very, very, very high dimensional features with kind of k-dimensional features, such that you lost as little information as possible in sort of some mean squared error reconstruction compression type sense. So we showed the best thing you could do is to take the k eigenvectors with the highest eigenvalues of this matrix multiplied by its own transpose, and that's going to give you this compression of this rating matrix that's the best in the reconstruction error sense. So, of course, we can just try and apply the same idea to document representations rather than whatever other feature vectors we had or whatever rating matrices we had. We have these big matrices then, where each row is a term or it's a word in our fixed length representation, and each column is the bag of words, in this case, representation of that document. And we can say, well, all right, let's just try and compress this thing. We can come up with some low-dimensional representation of the document by taking the eigenvectors of X by its own transpose, sorry, X transpose by X, and we can find a low-dimensional representation of the term by taking the eigenvectors of X transpose. So if the math is not so obvious, you can think about what this really looks like. You have this big matrix, which is something like your bag of words matrix. It's, what did I say, the rows are terms, and the columns are documents. So a single column of this is the bag of words. This pen is horrible. Bag of words representation of document D. And we're going to say that's approximately equal to these two thin matrices, one of which is T by K and the other of which is K by D. So this is some sort of low-dimensional representation of the doc. And this is, this is low-dimensional representation of the term. And this is a low-dimensional representation of the doc. Okay, so, oh my goodness, what have I done? I thought I had an empty slide or two there. I did not. I'll add one in later when I put the slides online. But, goodness me, what am I going to do? I'll add one in now. Okay, we can. Sorry about this. I think we're in good shape now. Okay. We can think about representing our bag of words matrix by this sort of these two thin matrices, or like we did with recommender systems, we can say, well, I'm just writing down the same thing in a different way. The bag of words matrix is equal to, well, the bag of words representation of doc D and term T. So how many times does the term T appear in document D is just going to be approximately equal to some sort of gamma D dot gamma T. So before we said, okay, we're going to represent a rating matrix by saying what are the properties of the item and the preferences of the user. This is now some kind of low-dimensional representation of a document and a low-dimensional representation of a term. So you can think about that as what sort of terms does this document use and what sort of documents like to use this term. And then the bag of words representation of a particular document and a term T is kind of the compatibility between these two low-dimensional representations. So I think it's a bit harder to think about what the intuition of those things is, but essentially, what can you do with a low-dimensional representation of a document? So what can you do with one of these sort of gamma Ds? You could compare two documents. You have two low-dimensional representations, just like you can say, are two users similar in terms of the low-dimensional preference vectors? You can now say, are two documents similar in terms of these low-dimensional representations? So even if they don't use exactly the same words, if they use words that have a similar meaning or words that tend to be used in similar contexts, you would consider them to be similar. You can retrieve documents. So if I have some query like sci-fi movie with a good plot, I could project that into this space by going through all of the terms and looking at their representation according to gamma T, and I'll say, well, what documents are the most compatible in the sense they have the highest inner product? So what documents would be compatible with that query? I can do clustering, and of course I could use these low-dimensional representations. I could use gamma T or gamma D as a representation of my document and then go on and solve any other predictive task, like we always have been doing with dimensionality reduction approaches. Okay, that's what we can do with a low-dimensional representation of a document. What can you do with a low-dimensional representation of a word? Maybe not so interesting for data mining purposes, but for linguistic purposes. Well, if two words have similar low-dimensional representations, that means they tend to be used they play similar roles in documents, so those words could potentially be synonyms. So words like action and fast would have similar terms for gamma action and gamma fast. So you'd say, well, those words are maybe almost synonymous with each other. And of course, if they were really interchangeable, they'd have exactly the same representation. And you can even apply this sort of idea across languages. If you have these two parallel corpora, maybe Wikipedia pages written in two different languages, they're not direct one-to-one translations of each other. But the documents should use similar words, except that the language is different. So we could find the low-dimensional representations and say, across these two languages, what are the terms in language one that tend to be used in the same document as terms in language two? And those words would be translations, basically. So this basic idea of dimensionality reduction has a lot of applications in machine translation. This whole approach is called latent semantic analysis. Of course, you can't actually do any of this because you can't compute eigenvalues and eigenvectors of these huge matrices. So instead, what we actually do in practice, like we're doing with recommender systems, is try and approximate these quantities using some sort of gradient descent type methods. So, you know, we want the bag of words to be approximately equal to gamma U times, or capital U times gamma I transpose. We want that to be as small as possible in the L2 sense. So minimize this with respect to gamma. That's going to be our objective. So we'll do the usual thing we do and take the derivative of the objective with respect to the parameters, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I won't walk you through the process. What is happening with my slides today? But essentially, this is how we'd actually solve this problem in practice to learn our low dimensional, why did I call them U and I? There should be terms and documents. To learn our low dimensional representation of the documents and the terms. Okay. So that's the kind of compression approach to finding topics and documents. I thought very quickly, even though it's not super relevant to this class, that I'd talk about the kind of probabilistic version of this model, which is called the topic model, just because it's so ubiquitous. But it would take probably a couple of lectures to describe properly, so I'll just give you the very high-level idea and point you to a bunch of refs. But we're trying to come up with the same thing, like to describe this document in terms of the topics it discusses, where each topic is a set of words. And we're going to do this using some kind of probabilistic model. So each document is going to be a mixture over topics. So rather than just having a low-dimensional representation of each document, we're going to have some probabilistic representation of a document. So the Chronicles of Riddick, every time you write a word in a review of the Chronicles of Riddick, you use 50% action words and 50% sci-fi words. So you'll just randomly pick whether you want to describe an action, whether your next word is going to be about action or whether your next word is about sci-fi. So every document is going to be some sort of probability distribution over topics it discusses. And then every one of these topics is going to be a probability distribution over the words it uses. So if you're talking about action, can you write down the probability that you'll use the word fast, loud, and explosion, funny, romance, family, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So again, you're going to have some distribution that adds up to one, which is called a multinomial distribution, that says, how likely are you to use each word given a topic? So that's what you get with the topic model. It's a different kind of low-dimensional representation where you have these topics, so it's a low-dimensional representation of a document that describes what is the probability that this document uses one of a fixed set of topics, and your topic representations say, what is the probability that given that a person is talking about action, they'll use each of my fixed-length dictionary of words? And really, what's kind of funny about this thing is it's like a random process that generates bags of words. So it's a probabilistic model that spits out realistic-looking bags of words, whatever a realistic-looking bag of word is. Of course, it has no syntax. It's just a random jumble of words, but one that should have the correct statistics. So to generate a bag of words, what we do is we say, well, I'd like to generate a bag of words that's somewhat about action, somewhat about sci-fi, somewhat about romance. So one-third for each of those. I'll roll a die that allows me to select what topic I'll talk about, and then say I get action. Then I'll roll another die that says, what word should I use? And I'll repeat this for every single word position. I'll just randomly pick a topic, and then I'll randomly pick a word. So, and this is going to be some random model that spits out bags of words. So you can imagine doing that. Here's my pitch black topic representation. So I roll my topic die, I get topic number 2. Then I roll my word die, I get the word explosion for the topic action. Then I roll my topic die again, I get the topic sci-fi. Then I roll my word die, and I just keep doing this until I've generated a sufficiently large bag of words. So, you know, here's a realistic-looking bag of words representation of my document. Of course, there's no syntax here. And then you can write down this very complicated expression, which says, what's the probability of my documents, given my complex low-dimensional representation, which says, what was the outcome of this dice roll, and then what are the actual models I use, so what are the topics discussed for each document, and what are the words discussed in each topic, and I'd like to choose all of these values so as to maximize the probability, like I did with logistic regression or something like that. So I'll kind of gloss over the details. What we want to do is estimate all these unknowns. We want to estimate the topics, the word distributions for each topic, and kind of the outcomes of these dice rolls that best explain the observations or the words in the document. So you want to choose all of these unknown parameters such that the bags of words you observed are the most likely. And we're going to do this using some horrible approach known as Gibbs sampling, where you just start with some initial values of parameters, like we always do, and we're just going to update each variable once, one at a time, using some random process. We'll sample a new value of the variable given all of the related variables. So it's a long and horrible process, so I'll let you look into the... I'll give you a ref and let you look into the details of how to actually solve this problem. What's maybe more interesting is to see the kind of topic representations you get. This is like such a model trained on the Associated Press corpus. You find that there are some, this is out of a very, very large set of topic. There are ones that correspond to some pretty intuitive concepts, like news articles tend to discuss things like arts, budgets, children, education, and very characteristic words tend to be used in each of these topics. And then for each word in a document, you can say, well, which of these topics is most likely to have generated that word? So, you know, Randolph Hearst is likely to be about children, foundation is maybe most likely to be about budgets, so on and so forth. So this document then is somehow a mixture over mostly budgets, somewhat children, and a little bit less education. So that gives you a nice way of representing each document, and also saying for each word in a document what topic is likely to generate that word. But I'll let you follow up in your own time about sort of very, very many extensions of topic models, how you can handle things like social networks and relational data. Maybe we'll look at in the very last lecture how you can say how these representations, like low-dimensional representations of documents, should change over time. And, you know, nasty, nasty things. This is some kind of relational topic model called WTF-W model. You know, you get these really, really, really complicated things that describe huge sets of dependencies between variables. So kind of that's all I'll say about topic models. It's something to look at on your own, but essentially it's the probabilistic version of something like latent semantic analysis. So latent semantic analysis is looking at the problem in terms of just compressing this bag of words. Topic models are saying, can I come up with a model that would generate realistic-looking bags of words? And the reason it's good, believe it or not, is because we can come up with funny models like this. We have a very, very, very flexible, probabilistic way of writing down what is the likelihood of a bag of words. And then we can add things like social networks or temporal information into that likelihood very straightforwardly and come up with extensions of these models that allow us to capture the semantics of text. Okay, so what have we done today? Before I probably use the time I have left to give a few tips about the assignments and also maybe to do that very, very nasty question on the midterm that everyone got stuck with. So what we've seen so far in the text section of the course is kind of the same things we've been looking at since the very beginning of the class, but showing how representing documents makes all of them more difficult or means you have to change them in some way. So last week we saw how we could represent documents using bag of words vectors and how we could use that to do things like sentiment analysis and classification. Today we've seen how can we improve upon bags of words a little bit by trying to find words that are somehow relevant. And then we revisited the topics from kind of week 3 and 4, so dimensionality reduction and recommender systems. We saw how we could revisit those if we're trying to model text rather than users, for instance. So how can you do these low-dimensional or probabilistic representations of documents in terms of the topics they discuss? Okay, so that's about it for the main material. There's plenty of references you can follow up on. So, yeah, like I said, I'll use the rest of the time I have, so the next 15, 20 minutes, just to talk about assignment one and the midterm. Any questions about dimensionality reduction while we're still thinking of it? Okay, everyone is quiet today after the midterm, I guess. It was just that awful. Okay, so assignment one tips. I think everyone's going pretty well on assignment one, actually. Task one is the helpfulness task. What would I say about that? The first tip, which should by now be very obvious, because it's exactly what the homework is about, is to use n helpful divided by out of, rather than trying to estimate n helpful directly. So people got stuck on that last time. This year I decided to just kind of give it away by making this a homework exercise. If you want to estimate n helpful, it's going to be totally ineffective to try and do something like regular linear regression, because the scale of this value is determined by the number of votes something receives. So you want to change your regression task, whether you're going to feed this into a regular linear regression or whatever you like, so that it's a normalized value between 0 and 1. So you're not going to try and predict n helpful, but you're going to try and predict the helpfulness rate that a particular review receives. Second thing is, don't get fancy on the text. This is not going to help you get a better solution, but it's going to help you from wasting time. I mean, after I give this lecture on TF-IDF and n-grams and everything, lots of people will try and run some n-gram-based classifier to say, is this review likely to be helpful based on the n-grams it uses? And my response to that idea is to say, well, what n-grams do you consider to be helpful? If a human can't do it, it's probably very difficult. Like, I don't think there are any words that are just more helpful than other words. So this kind of very, very fine-grained feature is not going to help you. The kind of text feature that's going to work is things like, well, if a review is in all caps, is that likely to be a helpful review or not? If a review has no punctuation, is that likely to be a helpful review? If it's very long or very short, is that likely to be helpful? Third thing, I guess, is user and item modeling or even category modeling. So we saw this in the homework as well. Some users just write more helpful reviews. obviously. What's maybe less obvious is that certain categories of item or even specific items could just have more helpful reviews. You could imagine in a book corpus, maybe people who read reviews of fantasy books are just more generous with the helpfulness rating than people who read reviews of romance novels. So different categories of items just correspond to different user populations that have different sort of rating distributions. The fourth thing, this is maybe the most subtle, is that nHelpful is sort of a very complicated function of out of because of the way Amazon services reviews. So think about the interface. It's impossible in Amazon to get 0 out of 1,000 helpfulness votes, right? Because if you write a particularly unhelpful review, they'll just sink it to the bottom of the interface and no one will ever see it again. Yeah? So if you've got 1,000 votes in total, it's probably going to be the case that your review is a somewhat helpful review. Yeah? So as out of changes, the distribution of, or the helpfulness rate actually changes. You've got to think for yourself about how you can actually incorporate that knowledge. Second task, I don't have anything deep to say about that. That's rating prediction. I think this is rating prediction. Alpha plus beta U plus beta I plus gamma U dot gamma I. This model's pretty good. It works. This is sort of trivial to implement. You did it for the homework anyway. This, I think, really getting it right is all there is to this task. You've got to know a little bit of calculus. You've got to come up with a pretty efficient implementation to handle 1 million reviews. You've got to regularize these terms properly. You've got to choose the right number of dimensions to use. There's no special trick. It's just coming up with a good implementation and figuring out all those details. Okay. That's the assignment. I think I have time to talk about the midterm. This was the hardest question, right? Yeah? Who got this? No one. All right, sorry about that. I thought it's a super fun question because it's something everyone tries to do when they try to solve this rating prediction task on the assignment. You think, well, my ratings are all integers and I have some kind of regression model that spits out real numbers. Couldn't I improve my model just by rounding everything? It's such an intuitive and obvious idea, right? And then people try it, they upload their submission to Kaggle and find out that actually everything got worse. So why did it get worse? Or, you know, well, it definitely gets worse with the MSE, which we'll prove, but would it get better or worse with the MAE? So we'll see. Okay. So first of all, what's the expected error if we round? So if you're rounding, the MSE is going to be the same as the MAE. If you round, your error is either going to be 1 or 0. You're either going to round it to the correct thing or the incorrect thing. So this description is kind of verbose, but it's saying if the score was 4.1, then there's a 90% chance you get an error of 0 and a 10% chance you get an error of 1. If your score is 4.4, then there's a 40% chance you get an error of 1 and a 60% chance you get an error of 0. So really the expected error is equal to just the minimum of these things. It's the minimum of A minus A and A, so ceiling of A minus A and A minus floor of A. That's our expectation of the error, either the MAE or the MSE, if you round your solution. This is just saying, are you going to round up or are you going to round down? The expected error is always going to be less than 0.5, and so you're just choosing the min of those two things. This sort of hand wave explanation is clear. This is sort of a, I would have accepted this answer as being correct without further explanation, but maybe people are not convinced. Yeah? Okay. That's the rounding-based solution. So how well does not rounding work? So what's our MSE if we don't round? So if you didn't round 4.1, then you have a 10% chance of getting an error of 0.1 squared. Sorry, a 10% chance of getting an error of 0.9 squared, and a 90% chance of getting an error of 0.1 squared. So your expected error is going to look like so here you you had a what am I doing? A minus mod A. So here you rounded down and you encode an error this large because the correct value, you didn't round anything, sorry, but the error had, the correct value had this probability of being this value. So you encode the square of this loss. And there's the opposite expression, which is A minus mod A squared. So the error had this probability of being this value, and the MSE then squares the error. So that's our expected error. It obviously simplifies a bunch. That simplifies to mod A. I can see this is too hard, isn't it? A minus mod A times mod A minus A plus A minus floor A, this is equal to 1. Yeah? Convince yourself. So this expression here is our expected error. Okay. Well, in the previous expression, we had the min of these two terms. Now we have the product of these two terms is our expected error. Both terms are less than 1. So the product must be less than the min. Yeah? Okay, so the MSE got worse. We can do the same thing for the MAE. It's a very similar expression. Everyone's pretty blown away by that, I can see. So MAE is much simpler. We have this probability of incurring this error, and we have this probability of incurring this error. So our expected error is just twice this expression. Okay, so is this less than or equal to the min? Put a question mark here. So we're trying to compare that expression to this expression, right? Is twice product of the two values less than the min of the two values? Well, one of these two values, when you double it, must be greater than 1. So it's the min times something greater than 1. Yeah? So the error got larger. So for the MAE, you're better off rounding. For the MSE, you're better off not rounding. Okay, that's it. I'll leave it there. So finally, the second assignment is out. I know nobody cares yet, but do think about forming a team, and I'll go through some interesting assignments and some data sets next week. The fourth homework is also out. Hopefully you don't need to do it, because we're only counting the top three. Spend your time working on the assignments if you can. I promise we'll have everything but assignment 2 marked by kind of mid next week, so you'll kind of know if you need to do homework 4 or not. And graded homeworks and so forth are going to be outside my office. I'll announce them before on Piazza beforehand. Okay, thanks.
This has been a UC San Diego podcast. For more, visit podcast.ucsd.edu.